This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Yes, it's Professor Buzzkill here, and I'm back again at the University of Virginia. Professor Sarah Myloff has agreed to come back on the show. Thank you for coming back.
Great to be back. Thank you.
The Buzzkillers demanded it. They absolutely demanded it. They want to know more about this fascinating look at American politics in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Professor, I was absolutely taken by, I think it was chapter five, the making of the non-smoker, the idea of a non-smoker as a category and as a sort of political entity and a social entity and things like that. It's absolutely a fascinating concept. When did that specific label start to be used?
Well, non-smoker as a political category, that mm-hmm. is a category that people invoked in order to make a claim upon the government, really accelerated in the early 1970s, which is when battles over public smoking, that mm-hmm. is, where should smokers be allowed to smoke, when those battles really started to emerge. So should smokers be allowed to smoke wherever they want? Should they be allowed on in enclosed spaces like buses and trains and restaurants and even hospitals, mm-hmm. as had been true?
Yeah, that's true. It was hospitals, yeah.
More and more non-smokers calling themselves non-smokers were saying no and asserting that it was their right, that they had a non-smoker's right to breathe unpolluted air.
Yeah, because I've always thought of it as a normal term, but of course it has to be invented sometimes, and this is when it was invented.
So probably the highest profile use of the term, and one that certainly caused heads to turn in the tobacco industry and then heads to roll later, was by Nixon's Surgeon General, a man named Jesse Steinfeld. On an anniversary of the Surgeon General's report in
1964.
An anniversary of the 64 report, Steinfeld gave an address to a consortium of health groups in which he said, "Non-smokers have as much a right to clean and wholesome air as smokers have to their so-called right to smoke, which I would define as a right to pollute." So Steinfeld's comments didn't change laws. The Surgeon General does not have that power, but they changed the course of his career. He was asked to resign the following year, and he insisted until his death that the tobacco industry was behind his sacking. But meanwhile, this idea of non-smokers' rights becomes very powerful among kind of a nascent and grassroots anti-smoking movement.
Yeah. What is the early history of that anti-smoking movement?
So the last time I was on your show, I talked about how the Surgeon General's report was very much a product of 1960s Washington, mm-hmm. with kind of closed and clubby connections, even between regulated industries and the regulators that were supposed to be doing the regulating. That begins to change in the late 1970s as more young lawyers began to crusade on behalf of the public interest. And of course, the most famous example of this public interest crusader is Ralph Nader. But there was an analog in the tobacco story to Ralph Nader, a man by the name of John Banzaff, who is actually still around. He's still a lawyer, still a professor at GW Law School. So in 1967, when he's very young, he's just in his late 20s, just a couple of years out of law school, he files a petition with the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. And in that petition, he says that a New York City TV station is not upholding its duties under a policy called the Fairness Doctrine. Now, the Fairness Doctrine said that broadcasters had to provide equal airtime to opposing points of view on matters of public importance.
All right. Yeah, of course.
Banzaff argued that obviously cigarettes are a subject of public importance. Hadn't the Surgeon General issued a report saying so?
Not even 10 years before. Yeah,
that's right. But what made his argument really novel was he said that the fairness doctrine rules should apply to cigarette advertising, not just editorial comments about smoking and health.
Okay.
And so amazingly, the FCC rules in BANZAF's favor.
Right.
And because of the heavy volume of cigarette advertising on TV at the time, at that time, 7 out of the 10 top 10 products advertised on TV were cigarettes.
Wow.
The ruling amounts in basically an $80 million windfall in free advertising for public health messages on TV.
$80 million back in the 70s? That was a really enormous amount of money.
Well, ultimately, the commission ruled that anti-tobacco advertising didn't have to air at a 1-to-1 ratio. This represented simply a 3-to-1 ratio of three tobacco commercials for every one public health commercial.
Lordy. Yeah, yeah.
And so this ruling ultimately paved the way for Congress, with the industry's assent, to ban smoking from radio and TV ads. Basically, the industry decided that in the next couple, but that after having been subject to anti-tobacco advertising, that it really wasn't worth staying on the airwaves. And
oh,
so
that's interesting.
And so by January 1st, 1971, tobacco ads on TV and radio were no more.
Oh, I thought they were forced to do it. And you know, went kicking and screaming into the but
that's definitely the perception that the industry wanted people to believe. They wanted the popular perception to be on the one hand, we're very responsible for agreeing to be regulated this way, and on the other hand, we are a beleaguered industry being regulated into the sunset. But really, it was done with the assent of the industry after BANZAF's crusade had basically raised the opportunity cost so high of staying on the airwaves.
Oh, I see. So yeah, that's very, very clever of him to be able to couch the argument that way. How else did what happens in the sort of in the populace outside the courts? Is, you know, the famous movement that you discuss, GASP, G-A-S-P.
So alongside BANZAF's kind of legal arm of the non-smokers' rights movement, he ran an organization called ASH. A lot of these 1970s movements were enamored of puns. So BANZAF's organization was called ASH, which stood for Action on Smoking and Health. Parallel to that, but at the grassroots level, was an organization called GASP, Group Against Smokers Pollution. Mm-hmm. So ASH did technical legal work from Washington, whereas GASP was a decentralized chapter-based social movement with organizations across the country, and in its earliest years was run largely by women.
Mm-hmm.
So the organization was formed by a woman named Clara Gowen, who lived in College Park, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And Clara had a daughter with a severe smoke allergy that basically prevented her family from going out to dinner. And at the same time, she, in 1971, when she formed this organization, was still reeling from the death of her father, who was a smoker and had died of lung cancer. So Gowen basically commiserated with her non-smoking friends, who she described as mostly mothers and a few working secretaries. She met in her living room with them, and together they took their first action, their first protest action, which was banning smoking from their own home by removing ashtrays smoking signs in their own houses.
Presumably, this one of the effects of this is whenever they had parties, it would be obvious that.
Precisely. Smoke, whenever they had parties, they were going to do their bit to change the social default by removing ashtrays because, in her words, non-smokers were absolute doormats for inviting smokers into their home and allowing them to pollute their air and dirty their clothes. So after establishing the idea for GASP, Gowen publishes a newsletter that she calls The Ventilator, using the resources of the local Tuberculosis Association, later renamed the Lung Association.
Oh, yeah.
And the TB Association actually was kind of the springboard for GASP chapters forming around the country. Because what the Prince George's County TB Association
did... And that's again in Maryland. Yeah.
Yes, Prince George's County, Maryland, was they mailed the ventilator to local affiliates across the country. So that's how initial word of GASP spread. So chapters in Maryland, the DC area, and crucially in California formed when they received a copy of the ventilator and then basically mailed Clara Gowen for information on new chapter kits. And so within a year, Gowen had assembled and mailed over 500 new chapter kits across the country.
So this is really a GASP anyway, is a really a local thing. It's all happening by, you know, it's not happening in Washington. It's not even happening in the courts. It's all, how is it working at the local level, at the ground level?
A lot of what GASP did, at least initially, relied on persuasion and education and did not even require laws to change.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one early initiative of Clara Gowen's chapter was simply to ask doctors' offices to change their policies regarding indoor smoking.
Smoking in the waiting room.
Exactly. Yeah. So they sent out a request to 700 doctors' offices asking them to go smoke-free.
Yeah.
Now, most didn't respond. But 50 did, and those offices went smoke-free willingly, and news of that was published in the ventilator, kind of promulgating a snowball effect.
Yeah.
Another similar initiative happened, of course, in Berkeley, where Gaspers petitioned to the local organic grocery store. They collected over 650 signatures asking the grocery store to go smoke-free, which the grocery store also did willingly, which was then publicized in newsletters across the country, spurring further such action at the local level.
It's amazing to think nowadays, it's amazing to think of an organic grocery store as having smokers in it, but of course they did.
Even in Berkeley.
Even in Berkeley.
So another aspect of GASP that's pretty interesting was the visual culture that it encouraged. In GASP newsletters, one could purchase buttons and bumper stickers that really were part of this movement culture.
Yeah.
Buttons said things like, kiss a non-smoker, taste the difference.
Yeah.
Or kissing a smoker is like licking an ashtray.
I certainly remember that one.
Yeah. Or your cigarette is killing me. Now, these weren't just to be funny, and they certainly weren't very good revenue-raising devices. They really only sold for about a quarter each. But they were intended to declare that a non-smoker was physically present and to suggest that smokers should change their behavior when they are around non-smokers. Yeah. And it was easier, perhaps especially for women, to declare with visuals that which is otherwise hard to say with words. It is harder to have a confrontation than it is to wear a button.
Oh, absolutely. Or to have a sign or not to have any ashtrays in the house and someone sort of may get the message.
Exactly.
One of the most gripping quotes I found in this chapter was right along this section where you're talking about this was, resentment was a defining emotion of the 1970s and anti-smoking activists cultivated it, drawing forth political grievance where personal irritation and self-blame had existed before. So it was like, it's not just removing the ashtrays and not just putting the signs. It really is talking about, I'm going to do this, but I'm also going to tell my congressman or my city council person.
Or just my friend who's also likely a non-smoker. So part of the non-smokers' rights movement was basically about reasserting the power of non-smokers publicly. Mm-hmm. After all, they represented more than half of the population.
Yeah.
And so, and yet they felt as if they were being subjugated in public by somebody else's habits. So this was certainly Banzhaf's strategy, as he put it, if you convince people that somebody is inflicting a hazard on them, they'll get mad and do something about it.
Yeah. Again, Banzhaf being the lawyer, he's taking the more of the legal track than the grassroots track, but still very prominent.
Right.
Another important thing that you talked about in this chapter is identity-centric social movements and the word liberation, which people used to use when what we now talk about identity politics. Did the non-smokers label themselves that way? And did the movement benefit that way? They say, look, this is, you know, we have women's lib, we have all sorts of other things, and we have non-smokers. It's also going to help make the United States smoke-free, but it's going to help this sort of movement idea from the ground up.
Absolutely. So non-smokers activists who, this has to be stressed, were mostly white, educated, and middle class, benefited tremendously by the identity and rights movements of the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So non-smokers rights activists talked about being oppressed by smokers.
Right.
They spoke of themselves as being relegated to a second-class citizenship by the ubiquity of tobacco smoke in public. They adopted explicitly the tools of feminist consciousness raising.
Oh, okay.
At meetings, attendees were encouraged to articulate their suffering at the hands of smokers. The idea being, as Gowen put it, people are more likely to speak out when they know that others feel the same way. So this idea that it's easier to find a shared sense of oppression if you begin to name the problem. But ironically, they also embraced Nixon's metaphor of the silent majority.
Oh, I see.
Which speaks to the idea of identity politics as encompassing both the left identity politics of the time and the right identity politics of the time. So they highlighted their own kind of numerical supremacy. They were the silent majority and suggested at the same time their own kind of seething resentment. So they referred to themselves as the real silent majority.
So the
point is, GASP really sought to get non-smokers to think of themselves as a category of oppressed people. And, you know, it's possible that for middle-class whites, there might have been an element of kind of romance and thinking of their own suffering as connected to the suffering of minorities in the United States.
One of the other things that struck me about this part of the chapter was it's almost all, at the local level, it's almost all women, and often then called housewives, starting these chapters and things like that. Was there any sense that this was a kind of a the problem? One of the problems was that smoking could be seen as very manly. You know, there's the Marlboro Man, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's as if this is invading our home when we don't want it.
I think that this kind of cuts two ways. I mean, on the one hand, non-smokers' rights activists that were women kind of marshaled the cultural resources of motherhood and womanhood to argue that they were being oppressed, and that in particular children were unwitting victims of cigarette smoke. On the other hand, in part because of the tobacco industry's efforts, smoking in the 70s was also associated with kind of feminist liberation. You've come a long way, baby.
Yeah. This is a good point for us to take a break, for me to satisfy my corporate overlords. So we'll be back to talk about smoking and a quality of life issue in just a minute.
This is General George Washington. I never go into battle or start a new country without consulting Professor Buzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at Professor Buzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back talking to Professor Sarah Mylov about the making of the non-smoker, part of her new book coming out later in the year, The Cigarette, A Political History. Another one, I keep talking about all these things that impress me and strike me about the book, and Buzzkill, you just have to put up with the fact that I'm a real fanboy about this bit. But how it was how that non-smoking really became a quality of life issue, along with a lot of other things. But how did that happen? How did it work? Or was it boosted? It helped by the anti-pollution movement? You know, did the non-smoker become another group that was accepted in the broader culture?
I think that it's very useful to think about the non-smokers' rights movement as part of the environmental movement of the 60s and 70s. And this is true in a kind of number of ways. First, environmental laws passed in the late 60s and early 70s kind of provided a template for citizen action. By the 70s, environmental laws encouraged popular participation in policymaking. They required public hearings that then encouraged the development of citizens' groups. And so GASP was basically part of this popular upsurge in single issue citizens' group.
Yeah.
And moreover, on a kind of philosophical level, the non-smokers' critique against cigarettes was part of this broader social demand for greater citizen participation in government decision-making.
Right.
In a way, it's the demand that goes back to clearing all sorts of smoke-filled rooms, to changing political culture of the 1960s and 1970s. Secondly, environmental laws help to give non-smokers standards to which scientific standards to which they could appeal. Now, the truth is, in the late 60s and early 70s, there wasn't all that much research about the pernicious health effects of secondhand smoke. Today, we know that secondhand smoke is responsible basically for the same types of maladies that smoking is. Secondhand smoke can cause lung cancer in non-smokers. It causes heart disease and other pulmonary disease. Yeah. But in the late 1960s, this and early 1970s, the state of research was very hazy, so to speak, on this point.
Sorry to keep laughing, Buzzkillers, but it is amazing how dense these things were.
So what some of these standards about acceptable levels of particulate matter as related to smokestacks, for example, non-smokers' rights activists to do was to say, hey, why can the EPA regulate smokestacks out of doors, but they can't regulate human smokestacks indoors when they're also producing the same amount of noxious toxins?
And it's right there across the dinner table from you.
Exactly. Of course, the EPA does not regulate indoor tobacco smoke.
Well, of course. Yeah, that's right. Not even today.
Not even today, despite it having labeled secondhand smoke as a class A carcinogen since 1993.
But that also brings up the question of this non-smokers' Bill of Rights that you talk about in the book and the ways in which the motivations behind that and the impulses behind that. How did that work? It seems to be they're trying to do it on so many different levels. It must have been very, very difficult.
Well, I think that like any movement, different participants are moving toward different goals.
Yeah.
But I think that what is true in the early 1970s is that demands for non-smokers' rights are not being articulated as a matter of science, but as a matter of civic entitlement.
Yeah, that was a very striking part of this chapter, yeah.
So even when Jesse Steinfeld, the Surgeon General, the nation's doctor, calls for a non-smoker's Bill of Rights, there is very little research on the physical effects of secondhand smoke. Even by the admission of the 1972 Surgeon General's report, which takes up the question of secondhand smoke for the first time, There were few epidemiological studies that would have established anything like a causal relationship between exposure to secondhand smoke and disease. Even at the press conference announcing the 72 report, Steinfeld admits that we cannot say with certainty that exposure to tobacco smoke is causing serious illness in non-smokers.
Yeah.
He can only say that exposure can contribute to the discomfort of the non-smoking individual. But on the basis of that discomfort, Steinfeld asserts that non-smokers have an equal right to smoke-free air.
Yeah, that's the civic rather than the scientific argument.
Precisely.
Well, then how did non-smokers' rights and restrictions on smoking spread across the country? Was it all these little groups or did things sort of steamroll?
I think there's really two things happening in parallel. One is the John Banzhaf track, which is making its way through regulatory agencies.
Again, the lawyer we talked about before the break.
The Washington, D.C. lawyer whose job is, in his words, to sue the bastards. So he sues and he petitions regulatory agencies essentially into segregating smokers and non-smokers on airplanes and trains and buses. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a kind of a regulatory agency story when it comes to what's under the purview of the FAA or the Interstate Commerce Commission or Departments of Transportation.
Sure. Yeah.
There's also a local story that's happening throughout the 1970s, but maybe you date it to beginning in 1973, which is when a woman named Betty Carnes lobbies the Arizona State Legislature to pass what is, in retrospect, a very modest law restricting smoking in public places, but it's the first such law in the country. The following year, 2 years later, Minnesota becomes the first state to pass a more comprehensive Clean Indoor Air Act. The echoes of the Clean Air Act.
Right, yeah.
You know, the echoes of environmentalism are obvious. This law goes much further in making non-smoking the social default because it prohibits smoking in all confined public places unless a place is designated a smoking section. Whereas before you'd have a designated non-smoking section,
the Clean Indoor Air Act
designates every place non-smoking unless there's a specific smoking section.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
At the same time, though, GASP chapters around the country are discovering that local ordinances are even easier to pass. And here's where GASP's decentralized structure grafts well onto patterns of American federalism. So 64 local ordinances were passed in 1974, 54 in 1975, 59 in 1976. So you start to see dominoes falling at the local level and slower but steady progress made at the state level.
Well, that's absolutely gripping. And as I said before in other shows and in our earlier show, it was amazing how different states had almost wildly different restrictions. You could be in California when it was practically no smoking, and they would still be smoking in Manhattan, indoors.
No, this remains true today.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
It wasn't until a few years ago that New Orleans went down kicking and screaming into accepting a ban on smoking in bars.
Is that the last one? Is that the last civic area, the last city to do it?
I mean, if you go to Las Vegas today, smoking is still permitted in most casinos. So it's still this patchwork of state and local laws because, again, the federal government has not taken the lead in regulating in this area, which is still a bit of a testament to the power of the tobacco industry in Congress.
Well, there's certainly that, but I'm wondering if... this new status, this new social category of a non-smoker, and then non-smokers having their own political rights and political motivations and ability to convince government leaders helped that a lot. And that's one of the reasons we see patchwork.
Well, I think it became a usable template that could move across state lines.
Yeah.
And this network that was laid down in the early 1970s certainly functioned to promote almost model legislation that then was adopted around the country.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. It only remains for me to thank Dr. Mylov for being on the show, for enlightening us about a very, very complex issue, which might have seemed straightforward, but wasn't. So thanks for being on the show.
An absolute pleasure again. Thank you for having me.
And we'll talk to you next week, Buzzkillers.